Hello and welcome to the Tech Diplomacy Podcast, brought to you from the Norwegian Consulate General in San Francisco. I am Gry Rabe-Henriksen, the Consul General of Norway. Technology has always played a role in human life. Yet, over the past decade, we've seen this role explode to a degree we can barely comprehend. As tech companies grow in scale, reach, and wealth, governments have begun focusing efforts on bringing these new players into the diplomatic discussion. In this podcast, we invite diplomats, researchers, civil society, and tech companies to talk about anything and everything at the intersection between new and emerging technologies, regulations, and its implications. Join us as we explore tech diplomacy.
Welcome to this Tech Diplomacy Podcast. I'm Cecilie Herslitt and I'm your host today. Today we are celebrating that we are ranked as one of the top five San Francisco technology podcasts for our contribution to the world. We celebrate this with a new episode and are very happy to have Naomi Schiffman here today. Naomi is the head of data and implementation from Meta Oversight Board, and before that, she was building the academic and research program for CrowdTangle at Meta. Welcome, Naomi. It's wonderful to have you here.
I'm thrilled to be here. Excited for the conversation.
Tell us more about Meta Oversight Board.
So if we think back like 7-8 years ago, there were a number of events that really lowered trust in social media and specifically in Facebook as a company. So there was the Christchurch shooting that was live streamed on Facebook and other social media platforms. There was rampant Russian disinformation related to the 2016 election. There was the Cambridge Analytica scandal. And at that time, the company started moving towards the idea that a handful of Silicon Valley executives probably shouldn't solely make decisions about content moderation on Meta's platforms. And the point of the board is to devolve power from Menlo Park and allow for global voices to weigh in with cultural, political, linguistic expertise. So the board was stood up kind of directly in response to these events. And so in terms of authority, the oversight board and the board is made up, right, of individuals around the world with that political diversity, global diversity, topical expertise diversity. So the board chooses content that poses difficult questions about content moderation. And so the board can decide for a particular piece of content, yes, it should be on the platform, or no, it should not. And also it can make non-binding recommendations more broadly about Meta's policies, about its products or operations that the board thinks may be underlying some of the reasons that Meta made the original decision about the piece of content. And the cases are really meant to be emblematic, right? So although each individual piece of content may not in and of itself be deeply meaningful, they're emblematic of broader issues that users are experiencing around the world. And so we've taken cases around elections, hate speech about towards the LGBT community, the conflict in Ukraine, conflict in Armenia, Israel and Gaza most recently. So it has covered a wide range of very meaningful topics to users all over the world. So, in terms of the recommendations that the board makes, Meta does try to implement the majority of them. My work is about assessing the extent to which Meta actually has done so, and then whether those recommendations had the intended impact on the platform. And we've seen so far that we are increasingly getting proof of that implementation and of that impact, and we do have some proof of changes in user behavior and changes in the content ecosystem.
If I understand correctly, Meta as a company has a content moderation policy and they are overseeing all information that are uploaded on Facebook. Do they have like own fact-checking people?
So Meta has a third-party fact-checking program. I think kind of similar to what I was saying earlier about Meta not wanting all decisions to sit with executives in Menlo Park that have a particular perspective, by partnering with third-party fact checkers all over the world, they are able to really rely on local expertise and independent expertise about the validity of particular stories that are posted. So that's, Meta doesn't employ fact checkers directly, but does have a really robust program, and they partner with the International Fact Checking Network. And these fact checkers are employed by newsrooms all over the world as well. So there is a lot of independence there.
So Meta Oversight Board is actually an independent body that makes independent decisions whether they will delete some information or a video or not, if they want to upheld it. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly.
And how can a decision look like? What is normal recommendation to Meta?
So I can give an example from a recent case. So the board will, a user will appeal a piece of content, or Meta will sometimes refer pieces of content for the board to consider. So recently the board heard a case about a cheap fake, what it's called, video of President Biden. The video had been altered to appear that Biden was touching his granddaughter's chest. And the board made recommendations around the necessity of Meta labeling altered content, altered video content, potentially altered audio content, right? Currently, Meta's policy only covers content, only covers altered images, right? So expanding it to encompass other kinds of content that are becoming increasingly relevant with generative AI. So recommendations can look like that, right? Add a label, expand your policy to cover these important use cases. Sometimes a recommendation will be about clarifying to users in notifications that they violated something specifically, as opposed to generally you broke the rules, but with not telling them specifically what they did. So those are some examples.
How many is on the board? And I see that there are great diversity and many disciplines represented on the board, from, for example, Helle Thorning-Schmidt, the former Danish prime minister, to Tava Kol Karman, the first Arab woman to win a Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, so we have 22 board members currently. There's great geographic diversity, expertise, linguistic diversity. It makes scheduling challenging sometimes because of the diversity of time zones. But to me, that just speaks to the real authentic investment in having a diverse board.
So do you have regular meetings?
There's many different committees of the board. They meet, so there's different panels that will hear particular cases. There's various subcommittees on the board dealing with case selection, implementation, which is the committee that I support, and any number of other topics.
This is the mega election year. 3 billion people will vote in about 70 countries around the world. Do we do enough to ensure that elections are free and fair?
Yeah, that is a great question. So everything that the board does really boils down to preventing offline harms. So like not misleading voters about their right to vote, or not misleading voters about the validity of an election, preventing incitement to violence, especially in the context of an election. And we heard a case about the Cambodian prime minister that directly related to that. And really pushing for platforms to make data available to researchers and civil society organizations so that they have as many tools as possible to monitor election-related content on social media. On that last point, I am concerned about the pullback in data access to researchers generally across social media. And the Digital Services Act Article 40 has a subpart that's mandating access, real-time access of public data to researchers and civil society organizations to support, among other things, elections monitoring. No platforms have really genuinely fulfilled that requirement, either because access is exorbitantly expensive, right? Twitter used to have a free sort of firehose API, and now they're they're charging something like $40,000 a month to access it, or per year, regardless, very exorbitant. Or because the tools are new and they're difficult to use for less technical researchers. Meta just announced yesterday that they are winding down CrowdTangle, which is a very, I used to work on that team, and it was a very broadly used tool among researchers, journalists, civil society organizations to do exactly this type of real-time monitoring, including for elections. They have launched a content library that is more comprehensive in some ways in terms of the amount of data that it contains. But currently, there are still some gaps in terms of usability when compared to CrowdTangle. So, you know, I hope that they will be able to close those gaps and ensure that in this banner elections year, civil society organizations, researchers, nonprofit newsrooms, those are all folks that will have access to that tool, can truly use it to play and fulfill their role in monitoring elections and keeping elections free and fair.
In its new global risk report, the World Economic Forum ranked misinformation and disinformation as the most severe global risk over the next 2 years. How does a company like Meta work to protect the public from misinformation and disinformation?
So, as I mentioned earlier, one of Meta's main tools is its third-party fact-checking program. Meta partners with fact-checkers through the International Fact-Checking Network and other bodies to fact-check and label articles being posted on the platform by users. So once an article has been fact-checked by one of these partners, a label is applied to it on Facebook and Instagram so that users can read the fact-check for themselves. And Meta may also apply additional enforcement mechanisms. So once something's been labeled, they might, you know, demote it, or they might add other, you know, interstitials or actions. So there is kind of a multi-layered approach there. And we also know that Meta is now applying labels to AI-generated content so users better understand what they're seeing. We like this approach because it means fighting disinformation with more context and more information for users, as opposed to just removing content, which is problematic from a freedom of expression perspective, and also just like an unpopular approach for users at large.
I'm concerned that we get a society that are more skeptical. Can we, for example, include social media in the school so we build up a critical thinking from an early age and include this in the curriculum? What is your perspective on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, in a world where people are increasingly getting their news from disparate media sources or from a hyper-personalized news feed, and we're losing the idea of one central truth that people agree is true. Fact-checking, right, media literacy education, as you just referred to, is increasingly important so that we do have some sort of shared standard of reality or shared understanding of how to check sources and how to know whether something is a trusted source or not. So I think that there is a responsibility on behalf of consumers and in the education system to do media literacy education. And there's a tension, right, between wanting platforms to allow freedom of expression, but then also holding them responsible when misinformation proliferates. So consumers have a role to play in advocating for the platform they want to see and not supporting bad behavior on platforms, right? Calling out misinformation when they see it, saying when they have been fooled by something, and ensuring that their, you know, family and friends are under, you know, seeing that actually that information was not correct. So definitely everyone has a role to play.
Exactly. And what I hear now is that we are actually balancing the freedom of expression, which is the First Amendment here in the Constitution, and on the other side, the downsides of misinformation and disinformation. So it's a balancing of these considerations all the time.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, nobody wants to be told by a platform what they can and cannot see, right? People want the freedom to make the decision for themselves as much as possible. That's something the Oversight Board has really leaned into in its cases, right? Give users the choice to see things, but give them the information about what they're seeing. And so it is that combination of you know, leave up content, but educate users about what they're seeing, whether it is through labels, through third-party fact checks, or other means.
How does the industry collaborate in this field?
So I think that, as you know, there's little to no regulation in the United States about these issues right now. I think that under the DSA, which you know platforms are now sort of implementing and iterating on the implementation of it, there are going to emerge standards and best practices for many of these issues. You know, there are organizations like the Digital Trust and Safety Partnership, which David Sullivan runs, the Influence Operations Partnership or Partnership on Influence Operations, the Global Network Initiative. So there's a lot of sort of civil society organizations that serve to convene platforms in a, you know, non-regulatory setting to discuss and determine and set some of those best practices and standards. I think the next level does need to be a, you know, more formalized regulatory regime where platforms, you know, there is a floor that platforms need to meet in terms of transparency, in terms of the practices that they implement to keep users safe. And I think thanks to the DSA, we are headed in that direction.
So what I hear is that the European Union Digital Services Act, the DSA, are actually increasing standards and protecting the people in the world from this.
I think so. I hope so. Right. We're still very early days on the implementation of the Digital Services Act, but I can share that from the Oversight Board's perspective, there was a number of recommendations we made very early on in the first year of the board's existence around the importance of telling users what rule they violated if their content is being enforced upon, not just saying you violated the community standards generally and not giving any more detail, but actually saying you violated this community standard and this subpart of it. And that has now become law in the DSA that you need to notify users more specifically, and platforms are having to report on the ways in which and the number of notifications that they are sending out to users. So I think that, you know, at least in terms of sort of due process, right, for users and as we discussed earlier relating to misinformation, educating users about what is actually happening and how they are being governed, right, within this platform, we are absolutely moving in that direction. And we can see that there's sort of consensus emerging around that between third party bodies like the Oversight Board, between regulatory regimes, between civil society, and the sort of NGOs that work on this, that is the direction that we should be moving in. And with the DSA, we're seeing it become law, which is very exciting.
It's a spaghetti bowl of regulations, and EU is leading with many regulations in the technology field. Is it so that American companies have the same standards across the borders?
So platforms, because of the way that their technological systems work, it's usually easiest to implement one standard across all of their places, all of their products, and all locations. It's very difficult to geolocate, especially if users are using a VPN, right, or something that masks their location. A platform can be inadvertently not following the law. That becomes very difficult when different localities have conflicting regulation, right? And especially when it comes to data privacy and regulation that is, you know, now kind of a couple years old, it becomes increasingly difficult to deconflict regulation. And in that situation, right, you might see more sort of geolocation or attempts to show users in a certain location something different, right? If there's a different age of adulthood, right, age of maturity in different places, then a platform might try to age gate certain content or prevent it from being shown at all. But in general, it's easiest if platforms can just implement the same policies. And Meta's community standards are global policies. They do not have different community standards for different locations. And that can be challenging because, as we said, right, there are different, there might be different, not only laws in those different locations, but also sort of cultural standards around what's appropriate or not. So a cultural standard around nudity in the Nordics, for example, is going to be very, very different than in a deeply religious Muslim country. And a lot of the challenges with the community standards that the board ends up looking at can come from conflicts when trying to implement one standard across places with very, very different cultural norms.
What are you most concerned about when it comes to the new and emerging technologies?
We've already started to see in the context of the elections this year, the challenges around generative AI. My nightmare scenario was brought to my attention by Dave Wilner, who's at Stanford currently. He shared a sort of a situation where, you know, what if somebody deepfakes an election official's voice and calls their employees, their staff, and, you know, tells them, orders them to take some certain action that actually undermines the integrity of the elections, right? And it's untraceable. that is my nightmare. And we don't have, you know, detection of faked voices is poor. We don't have good protections against that. So that's my personal nightmare scenario that keeps me up at night for this year. However, right, it's not all bad. We also see that LLMs can be used for content moderation. OpenAI does use LLMs for their content moderation, large language models, excuse me, for content moderation. And in some cases, those models can be more accurate than human moderators making the same decisions. So it's definitely not a silver bullet, but it does address some of the challenges related to content moderation at scale that were not solved by pre-LLM technology, and that may allow nuance at scale at a level that was not possible without this technology.
Let's take that one step further and consider the US election this year. Here we have the swing states. And if you target the swing states with misinformation, you can influence the outcome of the election. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's right. And I think we've seen it happen already, right? It's actually, that's the thing about generative AI is you can produce maybe more convincing misinformation, video misinformation, visual misinformation at a scale that was not previously possible. You can flood the zone. But there was already rampant misinformation happening in the 2020 election, the 2020 presidential election, and the midterms as well. But, we saw misinformation about, ballots being used on Sharpies in Arizona that the ballots were no longer valid and that there was sort of tampering happening by elections officials. So that's actually not a new dynamic. It's really just the scale and the amount that we're talking about here. Again, that's why media literacy is so important and the ability for civil society organizations, researchers, journalists to have access to this public data from platforms in real time so that they can work as a team, right, and alongside platforms to call out that misinformation as soon as it surfaces. And that contributes to my fears about this election here.
So all of these actors you mentioned have a role to play, very important role to play.
Absolutely.
What can we do as consumers?
Yeah, so I think that, consumers, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, really need to advocate for the platforms that they want to see and not enable bad behavior on platforms, right? So if you have accidentally promoted misinformation and you realize that it's misinformation, correcting that publicly, right? And ensuring that, like, yes, it can be embarrassing to say, I shared this and it was wrong, but it's so critical for a robust information environment where we have some level of trust in an objective standard of reality. And I think consumers also need to advocate for the policies that they want to see with platforms. I think it's very easy to just want sort of your side to win, right? I'm making air quotes here, not visible in the podcast. But fundamentally, it's about, you know, again, like a healthy information environment with some shared standard of reality, and being willing to look for sort of robust, fact-checked, objective truths when it comes to politicians, when it comes to what politicians have done or said, contextualizing that historically, all of that is really critical for consumers to participate in.
What is the best practice in this field?
At least among the social media platforms, right? I think that the best practice of applying an interstitial, right, or like a label when something has been fact-checked or maybe in doubt is that is a best practice among the platforms. And that's done in different ways, right? Facebook has its third-party fact-checking program. Twitter has, has community notes, right, where there are volunteer people who can annotate, basically, if somebody posts something incorrect, right, they can say, you know, here's this added context, or not incorrect, right, post a particular perspective on something, they can say, here's this added context that may flesh out and provide a more fulsome picture of the topic being discussed here. And I think that, and Community Notes launched before Elon Musk, took over at X or Twitter, but I think it was a successful program, and I think it remains a successful program. So that has been a very interesting sort of approach that other platforms, as far as I'm aware, are not doing. So I think that there is definitely a best practice emerging that it is the responsibility of the platform to some extent to allow that kind of either independent fact checking or community sort of checking of information that's being spread. I mean, on Reddit, you have links being posted, but there's always going to be a robust comments section on any post where things are being discussed and you get multiple perspectives. So I would say that is a minimum, has become a best practice. Like, there needs to be some ability to respond, right, or to get an objective or as objective as possible perspective. But I do not think that there is like a solid best practice. Like, everyone is kind of trying out different approaches still.
Naomi, we hope we can continue this discussion outside the studio. Thank you so much for joining us today to talk about Meta Oversight Board and how you work to protect the public from misinformation and disinformation.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.